Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 305 of the Roguecast, recorded September 15th, 2020. Underwater Ice Ninjas.
All right, so we have a bigger than usual news week.
There's a bunch of stuff
coming out. Yeah, there's some trailers and stuff. DC had their second week of Fandome, which presented almost no news, but
right,
like, there's a couple tidbits.
Right, it seems like it had more to do with, like, still somehow their TV shows and things like that, yeah. And really just not as much comic-y stuff.
Yeah, it's almost like DC has no interest in comics.
I feel like Jim Lee said he was going to make an announcement this week, which is weird that you don't make an announcement at your Fandome, but instead the week after.
Maybe his announcement is, "I'm going back to Wildcats."
I have this feeling that he's doing some art for it, and he's burning the midnight oil trying to get it done, because we know he's always late on art.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was probably supposed to be ready for Fandome, but he's like, give me two more days.
He's going to hold it up, and it's going to be just that picture of that dick butt.
And I'm going to go on the outside crazy pants theory that he's going to announce that Marvel has bought DC and they are now one universe. All
right. Well, Nick, if that happens, I owe you a Coke.
And he is going to... Jim Lee is going to be writing and drawing a new X-Men meets Justice League book.
I could see that. And
don't they still have
the
Wildstorm license? It needs to be X-Men Wildcats.
X-Men Wildcats.
No.
I mean, their heroes. X-Men Wildcats are pretty similar.
They're heroes, not zeros.
It's true. So before we get to that, let's talk about store news real quick. There was some notable gaming stuff. We got a restock on the Root board game and the expansions. We've got a new game, Small World of Warcraft, which is the Small World game mixed with the Warcraft world.
Yep.
Yeah, and for those of you who haven't played Days of Wonders Small World, it is a really, really clever game sort of area control with fantasy races in there. There's a bit of a tongue-in-cheek element as the races get combined with cool modifiers.
Yep.
Like, you know, the mountain dwarves or the, you know...
Flying goblins
and stuff like that. And they end up with some fun ones like the... diplomatic skeletons.
Yeah.
And, like, if you have the diplomatic power, then that means, like, on certain turns that, like, somebody might be attacking your armies, you can say, nope, our diplomats make you talk you down or whatever. Yeah. You cannot attack.
Yeah. Now it gets bonus, what, Horde? And what's the other
the
faction?
Alliance. Now it's the Alliance. There's, like, 12 different factions that are in there.
16
12
different races.
Or no 16.
More, 16 different races. No more locks.
Yeah, don't buy it. There's no more locks.
But they've got the Tauren and the Pandarians.
Blood Elves and all the other rest. Yeah.
Happy to see the Pandarians.
And it looks beautiful. The original one had really nice artwork, and this one, of course, because, you know, this game has so much cool art associated with it, of course it looks beautiful.
Yep.
What else we got, right?
And it also comes with bonus dice. In the hobby trade, you get a set of bonus Small World dice.
Is this something, an extra that we have,
yep,
or is this...
Yep, something that we have.
Neat. It's not just, like, dice are in the box.
Right.
Good. Well, people get them all you can get the dice.
We got a few pre-painted Pathfinder minis, which are really nice looking.
Yeah.
And
we did talk about just all the new minis the other week,
we
right?
Did. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And then the big thing, big release is the D&D Icewind Dale Rime of the Frostmen. Not rhyme as in R-H-Y-M-E, but rhyme as in R-I-M-E,
yep,
like Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Yep.
What does that mean? Dave, what does rhyme mean?
Rhyme refers to that, like, chilly layer of frost that you might find on something in the freezer or in the cold. It is like a frost layer.
So is the frost layer the Frost Maiden?
Yes, something.
Is it the frost layer the Ancient Mariner as well?
Yes.
Covered in frost? Is that his deal?
They do pass through an area that's cold and icy, I think.
I've never read Rime of the Ancient Mariner. I know it's a thing.
It's actually really, it's a really enticing read. It's a kind of epic poem that has a kind of a cool, creepy, mysterious bent to it, and, it's
any,
fun.
Any ninjas in it, or,
Yeah.
Yeah?
Okay. Sure.
All right, good.
Why not?
Evil clowns?
No. Don't be stupid.
Underwater ice ninjas?
Yes. So we've got the Icewind Dale book, which has I think a bunch of new monsters and stuff.
Yeah.
Stunning artwork in it, just like some of the best I've seen,
including this crazy owl thing on the cover called the Old Crone.
Yeah, it's like
crone.
It looks like a humanoid person. I don't know how big it is, like if it's a giant or what.
It's a big mini. It's a large
but,
mini.
But but with like a giant snow owl's face and like the horns of a ram on it. Yep. It's so cool looking.
Now we all love owlbears here, so if they've made some kind of cool cold owlbear, I'm down with it.
I'm excited that the one of the minis in these is an abominable Yeti.
Yep.
And the Yeti looks badass.
It does.
He's got like horns and stuff.
What is that little thing with the snowball?
That is a Twinga.
Is it some kind of like little goblin-y thing?
It looks like a little goblin-y
thing. Yeah, a little goblin-y
thing. Oh, there's like some kind of little new ice goblin race.
Yeah.
So, but there's also, is this basically a big adventure, Randy?
Yeah, so basically, and I'm looking at the minis here.
It'd be like when they got the Waterdeep book.
An unnatural, never-ending snowstorm has descended upon the region, and adventurers from across Faerun have arrived to investigate its source. Will you be able to discover the cause of the storm, or will the 10 towns be forever buried underneath the snow?
Sounds cool. I know we know just from press. I don't know if any of us have. Nobody's had a chance to do a close read of it or anything. But this is supposed to reflect some horror themes.
Yeah, a little bit horrific.
Nick, I think you told me even The Thing specifically. John Carpenter's The Thing. Was it you who told me that?
Mm-mm.
Somebody told me that was like a specific influence.
Dave, that was The Ancient Mariner when he was in here.
Oh my goodness!
And then he was like, "You guys buy comics."
I have a Superman that I want to sell you.
The point, though, is The Thing is like super awesome movie with a real sense of like that bitter cold atmosphere of the North Pole. And if they can channel some of that for this, I think that's a really cool notion.
It looks super cool. Also, there is an awesome limited edition cover thing,
yep.
Which unfortunately we are out of already.
Randy, you were away when we found out we were able to get three more, of which I believe one is already spoken for.
Okay,
They're basically gone.
Wow.
We can get the regular cover, which is cool too.
Yeah.
But by the time limited you're hearing this, we probably this won't have the limited cover available.
That's crazy. It's been a while since one's been limited like that.
Yeah.
This is a cool new adventure from them. All right. Oh, and also we should mention the giant. There's always a special giant miniature thing
yes.
to do.
Yes.
And this week it is the Cairnan dragon or something like that.
Yeah, it's like a.
It's a construct dragon.
Cardolan dragon.
It looks like it's actually like a xenomorph alien. It's not quite that detailed, but it has an alien look to it.
It looks like the squiddy aliens from The Matrix, sort of. It's got like the...
Yeah.
And not to be dismissive of him, but he is kind of chonky, and I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Anna was looking at it, and she's like, he's a chonky boy.
He's a terrifying chonky boy.
Yeah, like, he is, like, big, like, a muscular, like, in-your-face dragon.
But I love that D&D continues to put out these giant dragons, because a couple weeks ago was the giant white dragon, before that was the psionic one.
Yeah, they're really cool. Anyway, it's a pretty cool deluxe mini. All right, let's talk news. Let's talk trailers. We finally got the Dune trailer.
Yep.
Now, Dave, I know you're reading Dune right now. You've read some Dune. You're digging it.
Yep.
Nick, where are you on Dune? Have you read any of Dune?
Never read it. Never watched either of the adaptations.
So you and I are
Nick,
in the same
among
place.
All of your movie watching, you still didn't like just randomly watch David Lynch's?
Nope.
I'm surprised.
I may have watched a few minutes of the William Hurt Sci-Fi Channel miniseries, and I was like, it's not bad, but it's kind of boring. And I feel like that is kind of where I've fallen down on Dune. It's not bad, but it's kind of boring.
So what's kind of funny is usually we are a spectrum. There's someone on one end, someone in the middle, someone on the far end. But in this case, Nick and I are on one end having seen none of it and read none of it. And Dave is on the other end having read some of it.
Yeah, and I have... I'm not quite love-hate with it, but Dune is dry. As it befits its desert theme.
Here's a question. Is it Tolkien dry, or is it beyond Tolkien dry?
It's more like Tolkien dry.
Okay.
Tolkien dry? Was that a wine cooler in the 90s,
yes.
wasn't it?
Yes.
It's Canada dry, and then Tolkien dry.
Ginger ale that's just dust.
It's dry in a different way, where Tolkien was like in his sort of his descriptive stuff. This is more in its sort of like... endlessly sort of intellectual politicking. Everybody in here, like, all... Everybody is, like, very... I had this thought the other day. You know, everybody is very wise in this. Even Paul, who's, like, only a teenager, but has this sort of these visionary qualities that expand throughout the book. And the Bene Gesserit women, who are kind of like this order of, like, galactic manipulators, for lack of a better word. People call them, like, witches because they do have powers and they can fight and stuff, but they are actually trying to manipulate whole civilizations.
Yeah, you were telling me some stuff. You've told me a few things on various occasions, but the sort of political machinations of seeding these ideas for centuries and eons, and then showing up and like making those things come to pass. I'm like, that is
it is one of the coolest, creepiest ideas. Is that they call it the Missionaria Protectiva. And what it does is they go to planets that they kind of consider primitive developing cultures, and they seed them with like religious texts and things like that. And then they'll go, they'll like leave and like not return for like, you know, could be a decade or hundreds of years, because this is kind of galactic timescale stuff. And when they come back, they like fulfill prophecies and stuff, and so that they can manipulate cultures. And move, essentially turn the tide of whole planets.
They're witch con men.
They kind of are. Theoretically benevolent ones, but boy, it sure seems like they're just like manipulative, like Game of Thrones bastards sometimes.
They're like Sawyer from Lost.
Now, from the outside looking in, having never read or watched either version, this trailer did make me want to see the movie.
The trailer was cool.
The trailer was really well constructed, well put together.
It's stunningly cast.
Yes.
Paul, the lead character, Paul, is like as a new guy. The Fremen, the sort of the rebels of Dune, called Fremen. What's her name?
The guy playing Paul is not a new guy. He's
What's Timothy Chalamet?
Timothy Chalamet.
Well, he's new to me.
He was in Little Women. He's been in a bunch of stuff. He's a very good actor.
Cool. Zendaya was who I was trying to come up with.
Okay.
She plays Chani, who's this person who's destined to have a romantic connection with him among the Fremen people.
Yeah.
His father, the Duke Leto, is played by
Poe Dameron.
Oscar Isaac.
Yep. Yeah. Oh,
okay.
One of his instructors in like swordsmanship and stuff like that is played by
Aquaman.
Jason Momoa. And I forget who. There's like another notable one.
Dave Bautista.
Dave Bautista.
Playing Harkonnen or something.
Dave Bautista, I believe, it might be playing Beast Raban, who is one of the sort of like thuggish enforcers, think of him like a local warlord on Dune.
That fits. I mean, that's what he played in. This is Denis Villeneuve, and he used him as a sort of broody, brutish like.
He was like, but he was kind of a sensitive brutish guy. And you're talking about Blade Runner.
Blade Runner. By the way, Dave, what I like is that I know just the barest amount about Dune to know, like, some characters, but really, you'd be making all these names up, and Nick and I wouldn't know.
I mean, a line of action figures came out, so I knew at least Paul and a couple of the other ones.
Everybody knows the Baron Harkonnen, the big man.
Yep.
Is Paul a reference, like, I hear Paul, and I think biblical.
Well, so the Bible,
Paul, my name,
the Bible is mentioned, like it is part of like religious texts that exist in this future. They exist alongside, but like they've been like sort of revised and clearly like kind of like changed over time to reflect growing intergalactic changes and values and stuff. But yeah, the Bible is mentioned in it.
Huh, interesting.
The names are all like meant to kind of evoke ideas, but like a lot of there's this sort of slice of Americana, like Duncan Idaho is like one of his main trainers. That's the guy who I think that's the one who Patrick Stewart played in the original one, and he's like this troubadour kind of guy and swordsman, and he's like one of his like best buddies and like a close advisor kind of guy to him when he's growing up.
So anyway, I know that Nick and I both enjoyed the trailer despite having not much knowledge of this world, and definitely it's intrigued me. Dave, as a semi fan, what did you think?
I thought it looked really good. I think one of the things that that is fascinating about it, which is that like on some level this is kind of like has a classic rebellion type almost Star Wars-y story.
Yeah.
Star Wars is known to have been heavily influenced. Tatooine is surely influenced by Arrakis, but like on the horizon of it, he has this sense from his visions that he might essentially set in motion a war that will go out of his control beyond the goodness he could achieve from it and become like a crusade. They use the term jihad in the book. And I think they are wisely converting that to crusade, as it's not sort of laden with a kind of xenophobic stuff. And I think relevantly describes the kind of creepy Western use of the word now, where a lot of like sort of racist organizations like those Blackwater Mercs and stuff, they use crusader imagery because they imagine bringing, you know, their crusade to the heathens.
Yeah.
So I think that having that lurking is like this really, it's like the opening line of the trailer it's his greatest fear.
You're
beyond that,
about the cast being stacked, though.
Oh, it's nuts.
So, well, Jason Momoa plays Duncan Idaho.
Okay, that's who that is.
It's funny because I have several friends who reacted to this, and they were like, "This for them is kind of like me when they started in the MCU."
Right.
It's like, I never thought...
Or some people for Lord of the Rings.
Like, I never thought I'd see this realized, and I think people are super excited about it because the trailer looks good, it's going to be two movies, and they're like, this is something they've loved for a long time, and it looks like they might be finally getting it right, and that's cool.
Yep. Who's playing Sandworm?
I don't know, but that guy's big, because that Sandworm is giant. I go in this with a little bit of trepidation because I'm not the biggest fan of Denis Villeneuve.
Same here.
I think he's really only made one movie that I actually outright like.
Which is Arrival?
No, it's Blade Runner. Blade Runner, I watched for the first time at home. I didn't go to theaters because I was like, meh. And I really, really dug it.
I really like Blade Runner 2049. I could not tell you a minute of what happens in it.
I didn't like Blade Runner, but I liked Arrival at least decently well. I think I remember when this was first announced, my joke was that he's a boring director, Dune is a boring book, it's a match made in heaven. anyway, but I got good vibes off the trailer. Yeah. It looked like it was going to take the stuff I liked from the book and realize it in a cool way. And I got the impression, and this is also partially from him talking a good game in interviews, that the changes he's going to make are things that I think are good changes.
Yeah.
That the characters may be a little bit less there to seemingly as support entities to Paul's rise in power. Like, specifically his mom, who's one of those Bene Gesserit people. She's like a badass in the book, but she kind of is like, I will do anything for my son and protect him and do all this. And she feels like an appendage to him. And I think he's going to make her more of her own character.
By Rebecca Ferguson.
If I had to guess, Chani, a.k.a. Zendaya, will be also a more fully realized character. And the big, gross, fat Baron Harkonnen, who, like, David Lynch's version made this, like, really monstrous thing, he's going to, I think, downplay his physical grossness, that sort of Bond villain grossness, in favor of making him more of a sly manipulator on the order of a Game of Thrones character.
And I just looked it up. Danny DeVito is playing Sandworm.
Oh, neat. Neat. Good for him.
I know. He couldn't play Wolverine, so now he's going to play a Sandworm.
Anyway, but I think it's a good-looking trailer. I'm down for this.
So, diverting from one sandy future to another one, we got the trailer for Mandalorian Season 2.
Yes.
This is a mood trailer. Don't give a ton away.
Right. Looks for like me, that makes it an ideal trailer.
I liked it quite a bit. I think the premise we're looking at is whereas the first had the big surprise of Baby Yoda.
Yep.
And now that we know Baby Yoda, they kind of had to do something else. So, like, you have to go find Baby Yoda's race. And something about the Jedi.
He's basically... It's kind of cool the way they talk about the Jedi, like almost like they've already become legend in the wake of...
Isn't that who his race are? I mean, isn't that basically what it's boiled down to, is the fact that they're going after the race of witches and magic people that they
refer to as the Jedi? Well, I think they're meant to, like, find Yoda race.
Yeah.
I think.
Oh, I viewed it as an abstract, like, because he can do all these abilities, that is his family lineage.
I thought they were meant to be Yoda race.
But clearly, whatever the case is, whoever's talking to him and telling him this, which is like an unknown voice.
No, it's the armorer. The armorer.
Oh, is that who that was?
Yeah, the armorer, yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that. Did they show her?
No.
Or do y'all just know that voice?
It's her voice.
Oh, I don't know it that well. Anyway, but they say, they're clearly saying you will be interacting with and seeking out the Jedi either as the end or in service to the end.
Yep.
But the way they describe them, it's like they're like this, you know, this order of sorcerers. And I was like, that's kind of cool. It returned an air of mystery to them.
Yeah.
And admittedly, this is supposed to be like, you know, what, 40, 50 years after essentially the Purge stuff?
Is this...
Because it's what, like 20 years after Jedi? And Jedi itself was like at least 10 years after the events of the Clone Wars.
Yeah, it is.
If not more than that.
Yeah, it is. It's post-Jedi.
So we're looking, I feel like, at least 30 to 40 years after they've been sort of excised from the galaxy.
Yeah.
You remember, they were legends to Luke.
Yeah, that's true.
He just wanted to be a pilot. So, now they're even more legendary. And so you see somebody, one of them, like maybe a hooded figure watching him from a crowd.
Yeah.
And they do that sort of thing where somebody walks in front of them and they're just gone after the person goes away.
Yeah.
So I really like the idea of maybe bringing a little bit of air of mystery back to the Jedi.
So Favreau has said that The Mandalorian is set 5 years after the fall of the Empire in Return of the Jedi.
Okay.
Yeah.
And 25 years before the rise of the First Order.
Okay.
All right. I guess I just don't know how far Jedi was from the Clone Wars era.
Right.
But
right.
if Luke and Leia were born at the end of that, and they're like, what, in their
20s? About 20 years, yeah.
Yeah. So we're looking at like about 30 years.
Yep.
At any rate, there's some little bits. There's the bits with the X-Wings, like, locked up next to him. There's what seems to be clearly a Cloud City flight sequence.
TIE fighters taking off, and...
It opens with him with the ship, like, his whatever his ship is called. I forget the name. Sort of tumbling through space with its hatch open.
Yep.
There's a funny bit with him in a bar where they're like about to throw down and Baby Yoda like closing up his little protective shield.
Yeah. Then he sees, and then you just have, hear like, a thermal detonator.
Yeah, you hear punches and, no,
it's not a thermal detonator.
Well, it glows, so I don't know what it was.
It's that thing that he has that shoots like 100 shots at it once.
Oh
okay.
Yeah, yeah. That thing is cool. The little dart sort of thing.
But I like that basically Baby Yoda is like, oh, I know what to do now.
It's one of those things that could have been like too cheap, like too annoyingly cute, but because Baby Yoda can get away with that, he can get away with that.
I honestly think Favreau and Dave Filoni are sort of the arbiters of Star Wars now. Mm-hmm. In the same way that... What's his name is the arbiter for the MCU?
Kevin Feige. Yeah, these are all guys who, like, it's sort of in good faith with the spirit of the original properties. They're the kind of people who see the property and they see what's best in the property.
Yeah.
And that's a really hard thing to do.
Yep. It is.
There was also a scene, by the way, where it's like some people, some Imperial troops on speeder bikes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They do a cool thing where they, like, go off a cliff edge, but, like, not wildly high up, I think, so that, like, when they hit the bottom of it, they can still, they don't crash, like, the speeder bike absorbs the impact.
Yeah.
But it looks like sort of hard off-roading with them, and it looked cool.
Yeah.
Speeder bikes were awesome. I loved them as a kid. They were my favorite.
Yeah. It's a good trailer, and I'm excited for it. Also, Nick, you and I watched the trailer for Monsterland.
Yes.
This is a horror anthology coming from Hulu.
Yep.
It's got a great cast. I don't remember who was on it, but it looks like I think there's a vampire story in there.
Yeah.
And maybe some kind of like haunted house story.
I'm definitely in sort of horror mode right now, so anything, and I love anthologies.
Nick,
so.
You're more in more of a horror mode than I am. I'm impressed. I salute you, sir.
Yeah, it has like Taylor Schilling from Orange is the New Black, Mike Coulter, Kelly Marie Tran.
Mike Coulter, Luke Cage.
Yes.
And Evil.
Yep. I am desperate for Evil to come back on CBS All Access.
So this
or whatever it becomes, which we'll talk about.
So this is created by, it looks like, or maybe Aaliyah Brown, who has... been like crew on a variety of things, but it, like this may be her first thing. She's a staff writer, so I'm not sure if it's
it's created by Mary Laws.
So this is a TV show streaming on
Hulu.
Hulu, okay,
on Hulu starting early October, I believe, first week of October.
Do you know is it like different every episode or one of those like different every season?
A different every episode.
Okay,
it's going to be 8 different episodes.
Recurring characters or
standalone episodes. It looks like
it's based on a novel called North American Lake Monsters.
Okay,
by Nathan Ballingrud.
Ballingrud.
So it says encounters with gothic beasts, including fallen angels and werewolves. Broken people are driven to desperate acts and attempt to repair their lives. Ultimately showing there's a thin line between man and beast.
I'm excited for more sort of standalone episodes. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah. Anyway, so we've got, you know, horror anthologies are always good. There's Creepshow, there's Trick or Treat.
Right. I mean, arguably Twilight Zone was a stripe of that, even though it was like sometimes not full horror, but definitely sometimes was.
All right, let's talk about the news out of DC fandom. One thing is that Doom Patrol has gotten a season 3.
Yep.
I know because I heard the cheer go up from Anna's house several miles away.
Yep.
She's been waiting for them to announce that season 3.
Yep.
I
think Anna was borderline angry at the...
Yeah,
not,
she was.
Actually,
she's
angry
like,
at the last episode.
Like, you don't leave that cliffhanger if you don't know you're coming
right.
back.
Let's see. So that's good news. I'm happy to hear that.
That's good. And then the Young Justice folks said that there is a season 4 coming in Young Justice.
Yeah, it's
got its own title.
Young Phantoms, yeah.
And the weird thing is, we don't know what network it's going to be on.
I'm hoping it's HBO Max, but Jim Lee has said that the DC Universe app is not going away.
Ugh.
And I don't know what that means, ultimately.
I need it to go away. I don't want to pay for that app.
Well, ultimately, I want Harley Quinn to come to HBO Max and for them to give it a third season because
Harley
it
Quinn
deserves
already has.
It.
Season 1 and 2 is on HBO
I know,
Max.
But no news on season 3.
I know.
Which is really sad.
Yep. We shall see. This would have been a good time for it.
Yep.
The only comic book news that came out was that Bendis is officially ending his Superman in Action runs in December. And then there's a strong rumor that Mark Waid is going to be coming in to write Superman and possibly pick up on Green Lantern after Morrison leaves.
Right. I don't know where those like rumors came from. The only thing I heard is that was definitive was that he's going to contribute to like a Batman death metal anthology thing.
It's honestly, it's Rich Johnson over at Political Reading Tea Leaves, which half the time turns out to be not true.
I'll give him this. He's not WeGotThisCovered.com or Cosmic Book News.
Yeah.
He actually does have a record of sometimes getting things right. Yeah. So I would say there's at least possibility there.
Yeah.
I think, honestly, to me, of the possibilities, I would love to see Mark Waid do Green Lantern.
I'm more excited about him doing Superman, because that guy loves Superman on a level that few people do, and he gets Superman.
Yeah.
Even if the stuff he's written, the Superman, what was it called? Not Birthright?
Birthright, yeah.
Was not my cup of tea.
Yeah.
I thought his, and Kingdom Come, I don't love as Mr. Wells loves. But
I know he would bring up some cool ideas, and he would have an approach that would probably be somewhere between progressive and old school.
What was the last thing he wrote for DC? Was it Brave and the Bold?
Oh, man, really? That far back?
That was like 15 years ago or something.
Wow. It wasn't 15 years ago.
It was. It was pre-New 52.
Wow.
Yeah, it was. It was a long time ago.
It was ages ago. It was when Supergirl was Teeny Bopper Supergirl.
Yeah, it might have been like 12 years, but it's a
while.
She
was like Britney Supergirl.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was like mid-2000s.
It was good stuff. That was actually... Yeah.
He was doing a super fun run.
He was doing that, and he was doing Legion of Superheroes.
Yep.
Yeah, which was also not bad.
Legion was mixed, but had some good stuff in it.
Yep.
So, I'd like to see both of them. I don't know why. For some reason, I'm more interested in seeing what he would do with Green Lantern than I am with Superman. I guess because I've at least seen some of the Superman stuff, but I haven't really seen him try Green Lantern yet.
Yeah.
But would definitely be down for either of those.
Yep. Yeah.
By the way, this is something I heard from a customer and like just saw briefly confirmed... But I don't know the details on it, but I heard that Poison Ivy is being remade as Queen Ivy, or that is to say, is like adopting a new identity.
I wasn't able to run that down.
I think I found a place that mentioned it.
Okay.
But the word is that she would be maybe becoming represented more like an anti-hero on the order of Red Hood than a straight villain, which it's been a little while since she's been kind of like, I think, a full straight villain anyway.
Here's a question. Does she have to change her name? I mean, she could still be an anti-hero as Poison Ivy, right? Like,
I think so, but apparently Queen Ivy is like an actual kind of plant or something like that. Okay. And I think they considered probably that if they're going to give her a new look and all that stuff, it'd be cool to have a name to go with it.
Okay.
And
DC did announce their next big crossover event.
Is this the kind of odd thing that Dan Jurgens is doing?
No, this Endless Winter is going to be written by Ron Mars and Andy Lanning.
That's a weird mix.
Yeah, it is.
Ron Mars, 90s guy, Kyle Rayner guy.
Yeah.
Andy Lanning, I haven't known him to do... like, Dan Abnett went and did a bunch of stuff, but Andy Lanning kind of, once they split up, I haven't really noticed what he's been up to.
Yeah.
But I actually do, what's the premise of it?
It
sounds like Final Night.
Yeah, it's a little...
Which was Ron Mars.
It got those vibes, so...
Wait, Final Night wasn't Ron Mars, it was Carl Kiesel.
Was it?
Yeah.
I guess is it that out of that came Kyle Rayner, basically? That was like
from
the last...
From what I understand, it's like an endless winter, or a winter...
Wasn't Final Night the last hurrah for Hal?
For Hal, yes.
Yeah.
Like, winter sets upon, like, the DC universe, and...
Theoretically, I like that idea.
Yeah, I do too.
But it's a weird team. I'm not a particular Ron Mars fan.
Yeah.
But what was it he did? He did some cross-gen book that I seem to remember I thought was okay.
He did a lot of cross-gen books.
Yeah. Anyway...
He might have written Way of the Rat, as I think about it.
No, that was Chuck Dixon. That was Chuck Dixon.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Anyway, I wish there had been some more announcements, but that, like, at least some of those have piqued my interest, so we'll see.
Marvel announced, I don't remember where this came from, but that Jonathan Majors, who I believe is he the lead in Lovecraft Country?
Yes.
Yeah. Is going to be playing. He's got a role in Ant-Man 3, and it seems like they said Kang.
That's what people. I think it is what people are guessing most.
Yeah, he's definitely been cast. He's going to be in Ant-Man 3. However, they have not outright.
They didn't say. I thought somebody in the article said Kang, or maybe
I think that became like the speculation, and then everyone latched onto that.
Okay, so
I'm not 100% sure.
No. On the surface, like, Kang and Ant-Man don't go together, but the quantum realm, which that Ant-Man has now been to several times...
Yeah, the time travel element.
...would be an easy way, an easy sneaky in for Kang.
Yeah.
And I like that idea. Yeah. I kind of am hoping, because, like, I don't think he would appear in, like, Ant-Man 3 fully formed as, like, I am the guy who's going to take over the universe and be the next Thanos-level threat. I almost feel like we might see him in some, like, lower-powered form, or, like, walking amongst people as maybe, like, even undercover at some point, like, to achieve technology he wants or something.
Yeah, my brain came up with a theory that he would show up, and then the Fantastic Four would come after him because Kang had taken over their world. Hmm. And
they're from
another Earth.
The Counter-Earth.
Yeah.
Hmm. They should have him turn out to be from the world that the High Evolutionary created. And you could go deep on this stuff. I'd be down for any of that stuff. I definitely like the idea of sneaking in the FF stuff. I'd like to start seeing it in there. The world needs to hold together just a little bit longer so Marvel can hopefully show their stuff on this.
Yeah, I have trouble getting excited about all this stuff at this point because, to me, Endgame sort of wrapped everything up and Homecoming was Far From Home was a good little sorbet, and I'm like, man, I need to see what you're gonna do before I get excited about your further casting and stuff. And I also need to see what's actually gonna happen.
Right.
I have a hard time believing we're gonna see movies ever again. So we didn't get out of pandemic time, so I can start being able to enjoy the speculation on this stuff again.
Yep.
However, I am happy to speculate about the prospect of Dick Jones, RoboCop creator.
This is a weird one.
MGM is developing a RoboCop prequel that would focus on Dick Jones, the evil CEO of OCP.
The vibe I get from people talking about this is that it is going to be, like, I kind of was thinking, like, sort of Madman-esque, look behind kind of manipulator people, maybe with some nuance, but also with the sort of arch satire of Paul Verhoeven and their dark future. And yet, I don't know who, if anyone ever, has said, I'd like to see a RoboCop movie with no RoboCop.
It's such
a weird concept. I feel like it either has to be a great script, or the guy gives a great pitch, or whatever.
Or something. Also, just a movie called Dick Jones. I just can't imagine it.
They wouldn't call it that. They'd call it RoboCop the Early Years. No.
He's not in it.
Rise of OCP. I don't know. Rise of ICP.
Dick Jones and the Insane Clown Posse. Yes.
If they just call it Dick Jones, I would give them some credit. I can almost see it.
I'm pretty sure that if you search Dick Jones in the internet, you'll find some movies, but not the kind. Not RoboCop isn't in them.
Richard Jones.
I just have a hard time believing you can make a full movie about this character.
I actually could see it. So if somebody said, I'm writing a satirical near future thing about a quasi-idealistic corporate executive who ends up becoming corrupted by the system, and there's going to be a lot of satire of the modern world as glimpsed through what things are like 40 years from now, and I'd be like, oh, that sounds like an interesting, weird sci-fi kind of premise.
Yep.
Nick,
remember when Cobra Kai seemed like a joke?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. Anything can work if you have the right people on it.
I guess.
Because the notion of, hey, we're going to tell the story of the bully from Karate Kid and it's going to be his story, sounded like a joke to me. And then, like a college humor sketch. And it turns out to be a really good show.
But if you're divorcing yourself from, like,
the action
you can't
adventure.
Have Ed 209, you can't have RoboCop because those are in his future.
Yeah.
You're just corporate CEO.
You can have Ed 109.
I mean, it still would have futuristic-y stuff, and
this is like saying, let's have a movie about the early years of Walter Peck. I would
if they did a comedy about the rise of Walter Peck at the EPA, they cast him as the good guy, I'd be all about that.
I don't know.
Anyway, it's a weird
hands
thing.
Down the winner for the weirdest potential movie to the years to come.
All right. A couple of little tidbits here. Overwatch has a new comic, London Calling, by Mariko Tamaki and Babs Tarr, which is a pretty A-list talent.
Yeah.
It's a digital only.
Yeah.
It's on their website. I think you can go see it now.
Huh?
But I'm sure they'll collect it at some point.
Yeah, I'm sure they will.
Because it's like a 5-issue mini.
What's the topic?
It's about Tracer.
It's about Tracer, yeah.
Okay. So basically you get to see Babs Tarr drawing Tracer?
Yeah.
Yep.
Cool.
It's pretty awesome.
And there's a preview art in the link, and it looks great.
Yeah.
Walking Dead, the show, will end in 2022. However, they've already announced that Daryl and Carol have a spinoff, and they're doing an anthology spinoff of, like, Tales from the Walking Dead. Of, like, that is actually an anthology set in a zombie apocalypse is a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's essentially, if you take any given sort of strata of people, you could take gangbangers. You could take a white-collar guy like Dick Jones.
Dick Jones, zombie fighter.
You could take an MMA guy.
Yeah.
You could see what would any of these given people be dealing, how they would they be dealing with the zombie apocalypse, and probably tell an interesting tale out of it. Now, I don't know if the world is ready for still for two more Walking Dead shows. Like, I don't know if people want it, really.
I don't either. But they must think someone does.
Yeah. Nick, you're zombie fan number one after you saw that movie Alive. You're ready for two more Walking Dead, which you haven't watched in ages anyway?
I will treat it exactly how I treat Walking Dead, or Fear the Walking Dead, and it's like, I don't believe it's, in its existence.
Does that even exist? Yeah, it's like the way I treat all the CBS shows, like, what, NCIS is still on?
It's not how you treat evil. There's a great show.
Evil's a great show. And hopefully it'll be a season two.
We're talking comics the week of Wednesday, September 16th.
All right. That was a of the week.
Pretty decent
and,
size week.
We'll be back in just a second.
There's a good mixture of, like, superhero stuff. Big Detective Anniversary issue.
Detective Comics number 1027, which, Nick, I think you said that is a decent... creative pedigree on that one?
I mean, it's beyond decent. It's probably, you could say, stellar.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, even if you were going purely on artistic merit, it's astonishing to look at.
I mean, definitely worth looking.
But I have not read it yet, so it could be El Stinko.
I mean, I know it has a story in there by Grant Morrison and Chris Burnham.
Yeah.
Greg Rucka and Eduardo Rizzo do one. I mean, Bendis is in there because Bendis has to be. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of their who's who of the DC creative teams right
even
now.
There were artists in there who I didn't know, but they were clearly doing their A-list work.
Yeah, it's true.
For me, one of the things I was looking forward to this week was the Image book Stillwater.
This was, I think, my favorite thing of the week.
This was really good. It's a, would you call it horror, Dave?
I would call it like a sort of... At this point, it's kind of more like a paranoid suspense story. Like it could be veering into horror, though.
There's definitely some supernatural elements.
So this is the story of a guy who's kind of a down and out guy who's like, what? He's fired. He got fired from his job. He's kind of aimless and directionless, and he's like getting drunk and getting in fights and
he's
stuff
got a
like
temper.
That. He's got a temper, and but I did yet find he and his friend sort of an appealing duo.
Oh yeah, I like the character work a lot. So this is written by Chip Zdarsky. And
right, that's the biggest thing is Chip Zdarsky of what Spider-Man Life Story,
Spider-Man Life Story,
Daredevil. And he's, of course, an artist, too, who worked on, like, Sex Criminals with Matt Fraction.
The artist by Ramon K. Perez.
Fantastic.
Who has worked on, I believe, like, Hawkeye and some other stuff. And it's gorgeous work.
Yeah.
The color is also really nice by Mike Spicer. But, yeah.
Amidst this guy's kind of screwed-up life, he gets a call.
Yeah, he found that he might have an inheritance from this town called Stillwater. They make their way there. Nobody seems to know what this town is. There's a little bit of that Lovecraft Country, Artem...
Yeah, they sort of like, oh, why isn't this town on maps?
And they get there, and there's a secret.
Yeah.
I don't want to give that away.
No.
But it's a good
little...
It's
still unfolding in that first issue, and will be, I'm sure, to come, but you get big stuff in the first issue.
Yep.
But it reminds me of that, some of these weird like movies like U-Turn, where things start out normal, and it's like a husband and wife, and then all of a sudden, one of them disappears, and everybody's acting like it's fine, and it's all, things have gone awry.
Yeah. It was a cool first issue. Like any given scene, I was enjoying the dialogue in.
Yeah,
it's actually this is like a weirdly a perfect example to me of a book that I get pulled into by just watching some people talking.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually thinking of sort of like the more writerly tricks some other people do of like overlapping conversations and captions that are showing something that's relevant to it and how it kind of like. That you don't need to necessarily be that showy with writing to draw me in. And in fact, I usually prefer that you don't be that showy.
Yeah, this was really good and a promising new. I think Images is starting to put out some stuff again. We love Firepower and some of those things.
Yep.
And this is one of those books where I'm like, I think this is going to be a big hit.
You know what? I think that anybody who is reading this is not like a huge audience, but I think anybody who is reading the Hill House Joe Hill books from that DC was putting out, all of which were good. I think there's a high likelihood that you would enjoy this.
Yeah.
If you like kind of creepy, eerie comics that are well written, check it out.
Yeah.
If you like Hill House and if you like Jeff Lemire books,
that vibe is in there too.
Speaking of Jeff Lemire, there is a hardcover collection of Royal City this week, which I think we all were admiring.
Yep. Yeah, that is sort of his own small town thing that did also was tinged with a little bit of eeriness as people mm-hmm. had sort of ghostly visions sometimes. But it was more than anything about sort of like a dying small town and the people trying to sort of a family trying to keep things together, keep marriages together, keep livelihoods together. And stuff as this was happening.
I feel like Royal City and so far based on Stillwater, either one of those could be a good HBO show.
I kind of agree.
Nick, what else we got on there? What's another book that you read this week that you liked?
I mean, I love Faithless. I continue to love Faithless. The Brian Azzarello and Maria Lovett. That's sexy horror time.
Yeah, darkly erotic mystery.
Yeah, this one is all about sort of a tour through, I believe she's in Paris. Yeah, she's in Paris. What happens when you have sex with a ghost?
Debauched fun.
I also have a bunch of X-books this week. Everything from Giant Size X-Men.
So the Giant Size X-Men this time is Storm, right?
Yes.
Yeah, they've been doing these. Hickman's been doing this to kind of like fill out, areas.
This is the last one. Okay. And this whole big thing has been a big Storm, because in the first issue, we find out that Storm is dying because some sort of brain fungus has attached itself to her.
It happens.
Yep. So they've been kind of going back and forth and trying to figure out how to do this through all the issues.
Mm-hmm.
This one.
Wait, did they all connect up with it? Didn't Magneto just go and, like, get, like, a base for Emma Frost in one issue?
But that ties... Yes. But
there is,
also,
there is still
sort of,
a parent story?
There it sort of ties into... Because White Queen is throughout. Phantom X is important, so he had one.
Okay.
And this one looks like it involves Cypher and Jean Grey and Monet. Emma Frost and... Monet St. Croix. In the other vein of X-Men stories, there is a Marvel Snapshots, which I know Randy and...
I've been loving all of these.
Yeah, because what? There's been a Namor one, and there's been a Captain America?
Human Torch.
And a Human Torch.
Right. These are very Astro City-esque stories.
Yes. Exactly. And this one focuses... It says on the X-Men, but from the cover, this is all about Cyclops.
Yeah.
And it's pre-powers Cyclops. It's like right on the cusp of getting his powers... But it's like him at the orphanage, essentially.
Yeah, basically, yeah. In a lot of ways, this is an origin story for Cyclops.
Yeah, it's a very thoughtfully written one that I think, that sounds like kind of boring material to go back over again. But what they do, what they bring to it in this one is that he is witnessing in his, like, early teens the dawn of what would be the Marvel Universe.
Right.
So he is seeing, the Fantastic Four especially... But other people who are taking their sort of what could be a disadvantageous situation and turning it into like these heroic acts. And it's clearly affecting him to the point where he becomes like obsessed with the FF and Reed Richards.
Yep. It is written by Jay, I'm going to mispronounce the last name, Jay Edidin, who is one of the people on the Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men podcast.
You're going to talk about that later on in the podcast.
With Anna. But I think he does an amazing job with this, and the art, I would be remiss to mention it, is by Tom Riley, which I'm not sure I'm familiar with.
I don't know the name, but it's really nice.
If you like really any of the nice. Art on like Mark Waid's Daredevil run, this reflects that style. Or Hawkeye's run from Matt Fraction. I really like this too. This and Stillwater were my two favorites this week.
There also was the second issue of Seven Secrets. Tom Taylor and Danielle DiNocchio, their story of a secret society basically saving seven secrets that will, I don't know, damn the universe. But it's all about a pair of secret keepers have a kid that they're not supposed to have. And sort of about him, the kid, kind of growing up in this world.
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of some saga elements to it.
Yeah, I can see that.
But the world building is really good. Tom Taylor just creates a bunch of fun characters, and I'm loving getting to see more and more of it.
Yeah.
There is also an Iron Man this week, an Iron Man number one.
Yeah, the new Iron Man one is, it's Christopher Cantwell, who is the guy behind Doctor Doom over at Marvel. He's done some TV, notably Halt and Catch Fire.
Yeah.
Doctor Doom is a series that's kind of caught an audience.
Artist is Kafu, doing sort of a painty Addie Granoff style.
I was going to say, yeah, it reminded me of the art on Extremis, which is, I think, a good draw. This is a guy who can draw cars, by the way, which is oddly central to the story.
Yep. So the big draw here is he's going back to sort of a classic-looking Iron Man, although he does have extra lights on him. He brings in a Patsy Walker, which is an interesting choice. And he's taking Tony in sort of a back-to-basics direction. He faces an old-school villain in there. He does a weird street racing thing. it's interesting to take. It definitely very different than what we've been seeing in the Iron Man books, I think.
Yeah, in a weird way, I could imagine somebody wanting to check it out both because it's kind of doing something a little different, but also because it's kind of some like old school people might want to check it out because it is something of a back to basics approach for Iron Man.
Yeah, I think I'm the only one who read You Look Like Death.
Yeah.
Which is the Tales from the Academy, Umbrella Academy. This is Gerard Way and Sean Simon. It's a miniseries focusing on Seance, otherwise known as Klaus on the TV show. He's the beloved character on the TV show. This is him in his early days. He's been kicked out of the house by his father, and he's like being the druggy wastrel and trying to find his way in the world. It's very much Klaus wandering around doing his thing. It's fun and funny. And it seems to be tying into a wannabe singer-actor that he's going to leave that life. So there's also a vampire drug lord chimpanzee.
For those
who like that kind of stuff. Anyways, a lot of fun. It's definitely the comic Umbrella Academy and not the TV Umbrella Academy. But if you like the show, you will probably like this version in the comics as well.
I appreciate that the comic is will continue to basically be its own thing,
yep.
And the show will continue to be their own thing.
Yep.
That's good. Let them each be influence the other maybe, but not have to mimic.
Yeah, I agree. I also read the Amazing Spider-Man Sins of Norman Osborn one shot, which picks up from where they've been in Amazing Spider-Man, has the various spider people, including Madame Web. Spider-Girl, Anya, formerly Aranya, Spider-Gwen, Spider-Woman, and Miles Morales. Basically, on a team-up to get Peter Parker to not save Norman Osborn from the Sin Eaters. Meanwhile, Peter goes in to Osborn. It looks like basically Peter and Norman Osborn are going to have to team up against this villain who's running Sin Eater, I forget what he's called, the scorpion guy of some kind.
You've been generally liking Sin Eater, you weren't like necessarily looking forward to it, but it's kind of drawn you in, right?
Yeah, I was off the Nick Spencer stuff, and now I'm kind of into it.
Well, I'll say this: you and I both really liked, I think, especially his Captain America run. Maybe not so much the tail end stuff when they did the Cap Nazi story, which that is actually basically its own separate thing.
Yeah.
But when Falcon was wearing the Cap mantle,
right? Yeah.
That was a great few years.
Yeah. So I kind of want to go back and read more Spencer stuff because I'm digging the Sin Eater story.
Nice.
There's also Thor number 7, which is more of Donny Cates' Thor. There is Immortal Hulk number 37 and Immortal Hulk number 0, which is mostly reprints of stories about the Hulk's abusive father, who's been a pretty notable figure, along with some new stories in here scattered in throughout by the Immortal Hulk creative team. There's the Heavy number 1. Did I get a chance to read this?
I didn't.
Is that from Vault?
It's from Vault.
So I only know the premise because I made the sign for it, the premise was kind of fun, is this guy has died, and I think he was kind of like a tough guy, a heavy, as they call him.
Yep.
And he's not going to be able to get into heaven, or I don't know if they straight up call it that or just refer to it as an afterlife,
right,
until it's like he does some dirty jobs for heaven. Like he's like he's got to go like bust some heads, maybe kill people, I'm not quite sure, in order to basically earn his way in. It kind of sounds like heaven is like a racket or, this manipulative thing. It looks like, maybe darkly comedic?
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe like the people who like stuff like Happy from Grant Morrison might want to check that out.
Yeah, basically he wants to reunite with his wife, and he's got to do some dirty jobs for heaven first.
Yeah, dirty deeds done
it says,
dirt cheap.
A story about the existential purpose of dumb boys with big guns. So that's pretty great. And then I want to mention that Old Guard Force Multiplied, Old Guard Volume 2, came out in trade this week.
Oh, so that if people want to get into Old Guard graphic novels,
yep,
they now got two choices or two things, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Alright, so that's comics of the week. We're going to take a second, and then we'll come back and talk about some TV and some movies and a podcast or two. Dave has departed and Anna has joined us so we can talk about some topics. Because Dave is behind on Cobra Kai, but Anna and I are both caught up, and Nick doesn't care about spoilers.
No, not on this.
But if you do care about spoilers, we're going to talk about Cobra Kai Season 1 and 2, and you might want to skip ahead a few minutes.
Yeah.
So Cobra Kai.
Yeah.
This is a show that I watched Season 1 back on YouTube Red.
Oh, I see. You were an original.
I watched it because I do a TV podcast.
Don't be such a hipster, Randy.
And so I paid for YouTube, even though the very thought is terrible. But then I couldn't bring myself to go back for season two, even though I watched the first episode back. It was free. I was like, oh, that's good. I know this is a good show, but I don't want to pay for YouTube again.
Mm-hmm.
So happily, as nature has taken its course, and YouTube doesn't have a TV network anymore, which is good. And so this went to Netflix, and now everybody's watching it.
It's, mm-hmm, in fact, on their top 10 list.
Yep.
Yeah.
At, I think, number what? Like 5 or 6 or something?
I don't know, but it's up there.
And it has been for like a couple weeks now.
Yeah. And it is better than it has any right to be.
So much better than it has any right to be.
Like, when I heard about it, I was actually a little bit angry, but I was like, I don't want to see the bully redeemed.
Yeah, I don't.
What's wrong with you?
I don't want to see the bully be the main character.
And here's the funny thing. I didn't know this, but this actually goes back to a joke from the Better Off Ted, How I Met Your Mother show.
How I Met Your Mother.
Oh.
That Barney's whole running gag was that he was like, Johnny's the lead.
Yeah, he's the Johnny's karate. The main character.
He's the one who does karate. He's the karate kid.
Yeah.
And that Ralph Macchio was the bad guy.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I guess they did an episode where William Zabka actually came on, mm-hmm, and showed up. But all of that is to say that they decided to, let's do this story. I thought this was like a College Humor sketch.
Yeah.
Like the Cobra Kai... but no, it is about Johnny... What's his last name? Anybody know? It's not karate.
It's not Johnny Utah. Karate.
It's not Utah. It's not Cobra Kai.
Is it...
It's not Johnny Thunder.
Johnny Williams? No?
Nope.
No, William is his first name. The actor's first name.
All right, I'm going to look it up.
Right, you should look it up. It's going to bother you now.
It's not Johnny number 5.
Anyway, Johnny, the guy from Cobra Kai who gets... beat up by Daniel, who in the Johnny Lawrence.
Johnny Lawrence. That's it.
Mr. Lawrence. So it's 34 years after his defeat in the 1984 All Valley Karate Tournament. He's in his 50s.
Yeah.
He's working as a part-time handyman. He lives in an apartment in Reseda, and he's just such a loser.
Yeah, he can't get over getting his ass kicked after, like, repeatedly getting his ass kicked by his shitty karate teacher.
So he lives in this crappy apartment.
Yeah.
And until one night, a fateful night, the kid who's moved into his apartment complex, Miguel,
mm-hmm,
is getting harassed by these guys outside a mini-mart type thing. And Johnny doesn't care because...
He's a piece of shit.
Yeah, he's a piece of shit. Because kids get bullied. That's just the thing that happens.
In fact, he bullied kids.
Yes.
So.
Until these bullies push Miguel into his car.
Which you cannot do for a cool dude like
Johnny. And then Johnny karate kicks these, like, 4 guys.
These 4 teenagers.
He beats up a bunch of kids.
Teenagers, yeah. The great thing about this is, like, at no point does Johnny... He's getting to be a better person. But at no point is Johnny not Johnny. Like, he's still...
Yeah.
He's an idiot.
You say better person. I don't feel like he becomes a better person until the end of the first season.
Yeah.
He's still kind of molding these kids into being him, which is horrifying.
I think what's so interesting about that is that he thinks that the only thing wrong with what happened to him is the person who taught him.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a really interesting thing to watch him, like, sort of realize as pieces fall into place, like, yes, I can give these kids confidence, and I can teach them karate, and I can teach them to be badasses.
Yeah.
But then, like, the pieces sort of fall into place as he watches how they, like, execute the things he's taught them, and he's like, no, there's actually something fundamentally wrong with everything that I knew from the ground up.
Right, he's like, no, I didn't mean it. They're like, well, it says on the wall, no mercy, and he's like, yeah, but no, like, mercy doesn't mean that. Like,
yeah, not within reason.
Don't you feel like he's fundamentally changed the psyche of Hawk
Okay, but Hawk, by the way, best character in the world.
He's delightful and
Eli
awful.
Eli Moskowitz?
Yeah, Eli Moskowitz.
Love him.
The guy who has, like, he's a cleft palate, he's got some surgery, and then
yeah.
when he first shows up, what's he call him, Lips?
Lip.
Or, yeah,
yeah,
lip.
He calls him Lip.
This poor kid who's been bullied all his life is this quiet kid.
He gets bullied by Johnny
and then Johnny, like, tells him to flip the script, and he comes in with a mohawk.
Yeah.
And they start calling him Hawk, and he gets a full Hawk tattoo on his back without
incredible.
Telling his parents.
He's incredible.
And then he becomes a bully.
Yeah.
And now, season two, Nick, especially, there's an arc with him in season two where it's like, oh shit,
he's
real bad.
Yeah, he's a monster.
Well, they don't delve into, like, a bunch of the kids, mainly just, like, three.
Yeah.
And they're all bullies.
Well, Miguel is a good kid who basically starts becoming, like, they gain, as Anna was saying, they gain confidence.
Yeah.
And there's, like, this is definitively a good thing for them. Like, they're suddenly not going to be beat up again. They are starting to feel good about themselves. They're gaining confidence.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they are putting that bully energy out back into the world.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty interesting to watch, especially, like, because what they're learning is, like, sort of how to not take shit from people.
Yeah.
But the thing is that what Johnny is teaching them doesn't stop at don't take shit from people.
Right.
It sort of just gets away from them.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually really do sort of like the parallels where they show Johnny as, like, a younger guy, like, also getting bullied by people.
Uh-huh.
And then sort of how he takes these teachings and asserts himself. And then, unfortunately, also goes too far.
Yeah.
And I think that in his mind, as he's, like, teaching these to these kids, he's thinking, the reason that I went wrong is because of who I was taught by. And if I could teach them, they'll stop where I should have stopped.
Yeah.
And that's just not the case.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really excellent, like, almost metaphor for, like, how people have to, like, unlearn after traumatic experiences.
Yeah.
Like, the things that they think that they know.
Yep.
Which is kind of, like, why I like him, because he's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
Like, don't get me wrong. Like, he's a drunk.
Yep.
He's constantly, like, an asshole to people.
Thinks Guns N' Roses is the best band ever.
I know. Guns N' Roses, and they just suck.
And he's also, like, there's misogyny. There's
yeah.
He's an 80s macho guy, so there's a bit of homophobia built into that. There's definitely women aren't as good as men. There's a little subtle racism, and
He's not a character that I would... think I would want to root for.
And
but
yet,
he slowly unlearns those things.
Because, yeah, we get the... Aisha is a great arc. When she comes in, and he's like, no girls. And he's like...
and then she, like, thrashes Miguel.
Yeah, and Miguel's like, we need the money, man.
What are you doing?
And Aisha is such a great character because...
I love her.
She is perfect Cobra Kai material, and it's like, oh, yeah, no. And so he's learned, oh, wait, yeah, of course, girls can be in karate, too. Why not? And that's...
Yeah.
Basically, Johnny has to learn in the dumbest way possible. He has to be—he has to see it happen
and be proved wrong.
And be proved wrong.
Yeah.
So I was not sold on this show because I ultimately thought it was just a show about Johnny.
Yeah.
And then when I started watching, I'm like, oh, this is Karate Kid Part 4, as I learned there is a Karate Kid Part 3 that I completely forgot about when you told me, Randy, that there was a Karate Kid Part 3, not the one with Hilary Swank. That's Karate Kid Part 4.
That's next Karate Kid.
That's the next Karate Kid. I did not realize that there was a third one.
There's a third Karate Kid movie, yes.
That actually has
Ralph Macchio. And not only that, we check back in on Daniel LaRusso.
And he has turned his karate career into a car salesman.
He's a successful car salesman, which means by nature he's a little bit sleazy. But he is also, like, super sincere.
Yeah. And he gives a bonsai tree with every sale.
Yes. And he chops prices.
But the stuff with that and, like, his extended
and his
family...
Wife, Amanda, is amazing.
I love
his wife.
I want to slap his son upside the head a couple of times, but he's still an entertaining character.
I love his daughter.
Yeah, his daughter's a great character.
And she only gets better in season two.
Yeah, and
as she gets more of a role.
Johnny has a kid who he has basically never been a father to.
Yeah.
Who starts off as kind of a delinquent and then falls in with Daniel LaRusso. What's great is this is also, like, ninja movie karate tropes. Like, the notion of... The son, my old enemy, is now the master of my son. Like, it
it's
is
wild.
Such,
see, I think his son has the best story arc.
I love his son's story arc.
Because he joins the car dealership to get back at his father and finds out that Daniel is a good person.
Yeah.
And
well,
he teaches good
things. He gets the family he's never had.
Yeah. And the other thing that I really, really like is, and this falls into more of those tropes that you were talking about from, like, old, like, kung fu movies and samurai movies and stuff, and this is a spoilery part, but, like, there is a moment at the end of second season two that's, like, the big season finale moment where Johnny's son, like, takes the fight too far.
Yeah.
And Miguel is the one, even though he's got the quote-unquote bad teacher, to, like, internalize the, no, this is the wrong thing to do, and I need to be a good person.
Yeah.
And it all backfires and everything explodes, because ultimately these are kids who've just been taught to, like, do John Wick, beat the shit out of each other style fighting.
I do want to mention the fight sequences in here are so phenomenal. Good.
Yeah, they're all good, especially the one at the end of season one with Martin Cove, which is John Kreese.
I don't want to spoil anything for you, Nick, but wait till you see the end of season two.
What a
throwdown that is.
Like, as I was watching that fight scene, I just remember there was a moment, like, as I was watching, like, the Netflix Daredevil.
Yeah.
Like, where he's, like, beating his way through that hallway, and it's, like, a big sweeping tracking shot. This reminded me of that.
We actually made the comparison on my TV podcast. Yeah. We're like, oh my god, it's like the Daredevil fight.
It's really.
But yeah, John Kreese comes back in season two, and that arc is great.
I love it so much, because you see Johnny as a guy who, like, he, like, desperately wants to believe that he can have a redemption arc and, like, learn to be a better person.
Yep.
And that sort of is his pitfall in allowing Kreese to come back into his life, because Kreese is like, I just want redemption too. And Johnny's like, I have to believe, as the person who believes I can be redeemed, that you can also be redeemed.
It's like his weakness,
It's so good, and it's a Shakespearean tragedy unfolding before you.
I'm looking at the cast. I guess in season two, Paul Walter Hauser shows up.
Who was that?
The dumbass from I, Tonya. He was also...
Yes. He is phenomenal.
He's an amazing actor.
I'm not going to give away... the guy from the
apparently his character's name is Raymond store. AKA
Raymond you already know Wikipedia gave it away. Stingray.
Oh. he's incredible.
He's great.
He's a great actor. I love him in
that's
everything.
A fun bit. I also love the storyline going with Daniel and his wife, where she is like, she's like, this karate stuff is not, like, she's like, I'm glad you're doing karate, but you know we have a business to run, right?
Your dumb childish hobby, come on.
Yeah. There's some really fun stuff with that, especially in the second season.
I'm looking forward to that.
Episode is the best.
I love, I was actually about to bring up the double date episode, because it reminded me of an episode in the first season where, like, Johnny and Daniel, they sit down and they have a beer together.
And then you're like...
And they realize how similar their stories are.
And they're going to do that, I think, every season, where they get together and they're like, oh, these guys should be friends. They both did karate in the 80s. They both have a love of 80s stuff. Like, well, these guys have way more...
They have the same family, like...
They were love with the same girl. They have...
Either side.
They're very similar, and they should be friends, but they keep running into one or two things that just cracks that in half.
Yeah, and it's so strange, because it, like, almost always is that same root problem, and that root problem is John Kreese.
Yeah.
Like, it's 100% his fault.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is such a good show. And the other thing is, like, all of this sounds like it could be, like, dramatic soap opera BS, but it's played really well. Like, it is really played for laughs sometimes.
Yeah.
But it is also, like, I care about all these characters, and I'm drawn into the story. There
are some shockingly good dramatic moments where, like, you can really see why a character has gotten from point A to point B.
And then there's also funny stuff like Johnny getting a computer and not knowing how to run the internet. And when he's talking to the guy at the pawn shop where he bought the computer,
and the guy's like,
I'm not the Geek Squad, I'm a pawn shop. And he's like, have you never owned a computer? And Johnny's like, no, I'm not a nerd.
Yeah, I am not a nerd.
Just
God,
the simple idiocy of Johnny. By the way, I also love that they brought back Lucille, Daniel's mother, for a couple episodes.
Yeah.
And she's great, because she was always, that's Mercedes Rule, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And she was always great. And
the only person who hasn't shown up, I mean, obviously Mr. Miyagi, since he passed away.
Yeah, but he's there in spirit a lot.
Yeah, especially in the season finale where Daniel opens creates a dojo and all his cars.
There's some stuff in second season too.
But the only person who hasn't shown up is Daniel's old flame.
Funny you should say that. There's strong indications they're going that way in season three.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Because she's the one on the boys, right?
Well, she was.
She was. Wait, yes.
Who was she on the boys?
She was for season one. She was the basically the mom to Homelander.
Yeah, okay.
She was, yeah,
she's very much not in season two.
She's definitely...
She was also in the old 80s movie Adventures in Babysitting, right. Which I love. Yeah.
She got her face melted.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. I was trying to think of a clever way to say that, but I don't think there is a clever way to say that.
No.
Yeah, so this show is great, and everybody should watch it.
Yeah, legitimately great. I think literally everyone in my family has watched it. My younger sister watched it, and yeah. She, like, normally is so picky with TV.
Yeah.
She, like, called my dad the other day and was like, you should watch Cobra Kai. And my dad watched the first episode of Cobra Kai and then called my mom and me and was like, y'all should watch Cobra Kai.
Yeah.
So... It telephoned its way through our house.
It's been fun watching my friends on Facebook discover the show, because it's just like, it's so good. And,
and
nobody would have thought anything of it. Like, who thought to make this show? It's crazy.
Yeah, it's so strange.
Actually, it's got a good pedigree. I don't know who the creators are, but it's got a good creative pedigree.
I mean, what's the next 80s movie that we're going to get a revival of?
I don't know who's
Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
There was definitely one where it was like we see the flip side of another bully. Oh, someone pitched a William Zabka also played the bully in Back to School, and someone pitched the idea of Back to School where the kid who was the lead in Back to School, that Rodney Dangerfield, the billionaire, has bought the university and has installed his wastrel son as the dean, and that William Zabka's daughter is now going there and has to deal with this idiot billionaire dean, and there'd be another flip where Zabka's the good guy now. And I'm like, man, I'd watch that.
I want to see a return to, like, Ferris Bueller or Breakfast Club.
Yeah.
I think you can come up with something good on those.
I want to talk about another show. This is a show you actually have to get a network to get it. It's Apple Plus, which I poo-pooed repeatedly, and
actually a pretty good
so I watched Mythic Quest Raven's Banquet, which turns out is a great show.
I need to watch
from
that.
The creators of Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and then I started watching the show Ted Lasso. This is based on a character created for NBC Sports. It's Jason Sudeikis, who usually plays kind of smarmy guys.
Yeah,
this is him playing very much he's from, not Missouri, Kansas. He's actually from Kansas, and he coached like a AAA football league to national championship. And he is this very genuine, he's got a very bushy mustache, and he's this very genuine, nice guy who gets called up to run a soccer club in England, despite the fact that he knows nothing about soccer. And it is kind of a major league thing in that the woman running the soccer club, her husband was cheating on her with, like, women everywhere.
Okay.
They got divorced, and she got the soccer club, and because it was something he loved, she wants to destroy it. So she brings in this soccer coach, this guy, who's this very sincere rube, who she's like, yeah, he doesn't know anything, and he gets, you know, the press hates him, and his team is like, you don't know anything about this thing, all the fans are mad at him. And as it turns out, his sincerity and his love of just coaching makes him kind of a good fit, such that he sort of starts winning over the owner, starts winning over these sort of snotty members of the team, and he is also, like, getting divorced from his wife because their marriage is kind of falling apart. So all of this is, like, going on, and it's basically an ensemble comedy. It's from Bill Lawrence, the creator of Scrubs.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it is this sincere, sweet, really funny show about what coaching is actually supposed to be. Hmm. Like, I am not a soccer fan, but just like I'm not a football fan, but I can love Friday Night Lights.
Right.
It's got that sort of sincerity of, like, this is what sports is supposed to do. It's supposed to be about bringing people together. It's supposed to be about making people better. And he, like, has an interview in, like, the third or fourth episode with this local reporter, and he's like, yeah, I don't really care about the wins or losses. I care about making people the best version of the people they can be.
Hmm.
And it's really funny. There's a lot of running gags. All the characters are great. His other coach is Coach Beard, who's this sort of very laconic, funny guy. The cast is amazing. It's like I don't know anybody in this cast.
Other than I was looking at the cast, and other than Giles,
but Anthony Sturdhead plays her ex-husband in one episode.
Oh, that's awesome!
So delightful.
But everybody in this is really good. There's a line between being sweet and saccharine.
Yeah.
And I think they do a really good job of it. It is so sincere, and it is like the warm hug you need in 2020 of, like, hey, decent people exist, and sometimes good things happen.
Okay.
I cannot recommend it highly enough. Hmm. I love it. I've started rewatching it, and it really just is a great show. It is one of my favorite shows on TV right now.
Hmm.
And I think a lot of people... I'm starting to see my... It's trickling through my Facebook friends. I've seen several different friends talking about, you guys need to be watching Ted Lasso. And I think it's slowly starting to get out there of like, hey, this show you haven't heard of, but you should watch it. And I feel like this is going to be one of those like top five of the year best shows.
Man, Apple's got a couple that are like that.
They do. They do. Mythic Quest was a great show. Like, legit great.
Well, and then the animation, was it Central Park? Central Park.
Yeah.
I mean, for better or worse, Morning Show was a solid story.
I know people really liked Morning Show. There's a bunch of good stuff on Apple Plus, but it is honestly worth it just to have Ted Lasso.
Okay.
I've never even heard of any of these shows, and y'all are saying that they're great?
Yeah.
It's on Apple Plus.
Apple Plus, it's a $5, $5 a month. It's a pretty cheap network.
That's not even bad.
Yeah.
But the pedigree of, like, actors and actresses that they got, I mean...
They threw some money at this.
Yeah. Morning Show is, like, Reese Witherspoon and...
Okay.
Mythic Quest is the guy who plays Mac from Always Sunny.
I love him so much.
As the head... He's, like, the creative head of this World of Warcraft-style game. And it's about life inside this company. They've just launched their new expansion, Raven's Banquet. And it is about the sort of egomaniacal... guy. He's this really ego-driven guy who runs it.
Huh.
And then there's a woman who's like the lead engineer who's just like just frustrated with him at all times. There's a couple playtesters, two women who are playtesters, one of whom is completely in love with the other one.
Yeah.
There is a...
is this the one Danny Pudi is in? Or?
Danny Pudi plays their psychopathic money manager guy. He's like a sociopath. Admitted sociopath. He's like, yeah, I just care about making money.
Wild.
And he's great. It's like, it erases Abed from your brain. He's so good at it. And then there's, God, who's the guy? F. Murray Abraham, playing the like 70s sci-fi writer they brought in to do. And he doesn't understand the internet game at all, but he's doing the fiction of it all.
Dang it, now this one is going to go to the top of the...
That sounds so good, actually.
So good. And they did a quarantine special. It's the best quarantine special I've seen. It's even better than the Parks and Rec one.
Okay.
Super fun.
I really want to watch that.
It is September. That means it's time to start watching horror movies.
Yep.
And Nick, I know you jumped ahead on one. You're watching Hashtag Alive on Netflix.
Yeah, this one popped up, and I think I saw somebody mention it on Facebook, one of my friends, and I was like, oh, that's good. And then I'm like, oh, it's a foreign language film. But this one just went straight to dub, which I don't usually do, but I thought the dubbing was actually quite good.
Okay.
But yeah, it is a zombie flick.
You're not a zombie fan.
I'm not a zombie fan. I think they've played out. I blame Robert Kirkman for this.
Fair.
see past 11 seasons of Walking Dead.
Yep.
but this one is more character-centric than, say, like Train to Busan, which was about spectacle.
Right.
This one is about two individuals trapped in their homes and having to find ways to sort of connect with one another.
I guess, yeah, that'd be relevant in 2020. Yeah.
Right, exactly. like I said, there's more going on than just zombies. Even though the zombies, they are sort of their fast-moving zombies.
Yeah.
And that is definitely plays into the larger story. But it's more about characters connecting.
Okay.
And I thought the main guy is a gamer. He's big on the gamer scene, so he's got like a hashtag, so he's trying to do that,
mm-hmm.
and then this that happens, and the girl is like, I don't want to give too much away because she's a really cool character, but this is a zombie movie that really connected with me.
Okay.
And I honestly, it's Netflix, you should watch it. It's very easy to get.
On a scale of 1 to 10, like how scary is it?
It's like. Like a 3.
Oh, okay.
It's not scary.
It's horror in like aesthetics, but not.
Yeah,
like
I mean, I also appreciate it that they didn't do a ton of zombie tropes.
Okay.
You know, we're Train to Busan, where I was like, okay, so this is what's going to happen, and this is going to happen. There were a couple scenes like that, but for the most part, I was like, oh, okay. I didn't see this, or I haven't seen this before.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that.
That is very unusual in the field of zombie movies to see something unusual and new.
Yeah. So. That makes me want to try the, is it Korean or
Chinese
Kingdom?
Yeah, Kingdom.
That's a Korean show. Yeah.
It makes me want to try Kingdom because Dave told me a couple of small details on their take on zombies, and it is more interesting. So,
there's also in a less serious vein, Netflix put up the sequel to the Babysitter Killer Queen. This was delightful.
It was
great. If you like The Babysitter, you should watch this. If you don't know The Babysitter, it is it's an 80s style horror movie, horror comedy action.
Yeah.
With Samara Weaving plays the babysitter of a young teenage boy, and it turns out she's heading up a murder cult.
Exactly. And members of the murder cult include
Robbie Amell,
which I love Robbie Amell, and his need to be shirtless in every scene that he's in is amazing.
Anyway, they found an interesting way to bring back all the characters.
Yep.
They did some really fun, like, I don't want to get away, there's some fun twists.
There are.
And this really is, it's like a fun 80s horror action movie.
Yeah.
It's Mick G directing.
So it's going to have some pop like Charlie's Angels.
Yep.
And, but the cast is great. The concepts that they do, I thought this was honestly maybe a little better than the first one.
I think it's a worthy sequel. I don't know if I'd say if it's better, but there's less Samara Weaving, and that's never a good thing. But,
true.
But it is...
But I like the new female lead. She's
too.
Great.
Yeah.
And the sort of story elements that with her are really, really fun.
Yep. I am I'm all about a good horror sequel, and I thought this was... I don't want to say much about it. I'm trying to be very vague, because it's one of those where if that sounds at all intriguing, you should watch it. It's super fun.
Yeah. If you liked the first one, watch the second one. If you haven't seen either... You should do this soon.
Anna and Nick, talk to me about Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men.
Oh, man. So, I don't actually like the X-Men. Or rather, I didn't like the X-Men.
Sacrilege.
Well, so the thing is, like, there's so much, it's just like a mountain of stuff that, like, feels like you have to start from the bottom.
And I get the idea of it being impenetrable. I mean...
Yeah. And so, like, trying to just, like, jump in at any point was always really difficult, well, until Hickman decided to, like, reboot the whole thing. But the other aspect that, like, sort of, like, pulled me away from it was that oftentimes, like, it does get, like, a little too close to real without, like, ever having, like, any real resolution.
Yeah.
But I started listening to this podcast because a friend of mine started listening to it and suggested that I do. And it is when it started out, it was a married couple who would go through, like, X-Men arcs, like, story arcs, basically, from the very beginning all the way up until modern times.
Mm-hmm.
And they would explain it in bite-sized chunks.
Yeah. They would jump around a little bit here and there.
Yeah, and like, for example, when they did, like, the Silver Age stuff, like, they included other, like, story arcs from, you know, like, maybe 2010 or whatever that, like, re-envisioned parts of the Silver Age in the continuity. But, like, by and large, they try to stick to the same narrative as they go.
I have not listened to as much as Anna, so I haven't gotten thing. But they do bring in guests. Like,
yeah.
I listened to a Kurt Busiek episode, and it was a lot of fun to listen to him sort of talk about Silver Age.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of stories about, like, the Phoenix Saga and how they brought Jean Grey back.
Yeah.
And why it was his fault.
Just, like, a bonkers amount of guests. Like, the one that I just listened to had Cy Spurrier talking about his run on Legion.
Okay, yeah.
And he's, like, I don't know, like, listening to some of the creators, like, and what I really enjoy is that the podcast hosts, they're really comfortable with letting their guests, like, just talk. And, like, hearing Cy Spurrier and, like, G. Willow Wilson and Greg Rucka, who've all been guests on the podcast, talk about their, like, writing process and the characters that they like to get in the headspace of and how they like to really introduce, like, story concepts to their work has been, like, super fascinating. And for that reason alone, if you like a writer who has written the X-Men, I would be willing to bet probably that they have done a guest spot on this podcast if they are alive.
Just a quick question. Did Rucka ever write X-Men proper? I know he did Wolverine.
No, just Wolverine, like,
he did Cyclops.
And Cyclops.
Yeah. Cyclops, that's right.
And that was what he was talking about in this episode.
Pirate
However,
Cyclops.
This has made me really, really like the X-Men. I mentioned, like, a couple weeks ago when I was reading Greg Rucka's Wolverine that a podcast had sparked this interest in me. This was that podcast, and I have not shut the fuck up about it for weeks.
Yeah, you went from Wolverine kick to What, you're on New Mutants right now?
Yeah, New Mutants. I'm fascinated. I'm just fascinated because they talk about these stories with, like, such... I don't want to say reverence because they are still critical of the parts that are problematic.
Mm-hmm.
But they just have such a deep love for the content that it's very infectious. It's sort of, like, spread to me and made me excited, so much so that I read a Cyclops story today, and I don't like Cyclops at all.
He's not the best Summers, but he's good. He's a good person.
He's the one we have.
he's no Kid Vulcan.
I was going to say, he's no Alex, but...
Yeah, I mean, I do really like Havoc a lot, actually.
That was just...
Kid Vulcan, better or worse than Cyclops, though. He's better, he's...
Kid Vulcan is...
Yeah, Kid Vulcan is like bottom of the Summers, right?
No, actually, Adam Extreme is the very bottom of the Summers clan.
Adam Extreme is an unconfirmed Summers.
I know, but everyone throws him in there because that is. Then it goes Kid Vulcan. Then
no one.
Then no one. And then do you include all of
Cable?
The kids?
Cable?
Like, do you include Rachel Gray and
Rachel's
Cable?
Rachel's technically not a Summers, right?
Well, she is from an alternate universe.
Oh, that's true. Cyclops is her dad. So.
Yeah. So it's like one of those things. It's like, I just know that Vulcan and Adam Extreme are at the bottom. Hickman has done a few things with Vulcan that have been a little more comical, and I can kind of digest that a little better,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to Vulcan, king of the Shi'ar Empire, which was... Brubaker, why did you do this? Why did you kill Banshee? I hate you.
out of curiosity, because I wasn't here for it, did y'all talk about the snapshot already?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, okay. So, and I assume y'all probably looped in the fact that it's written by Jay Edidin, who is the host of this podcast.
Yes. Yep.
Cool. All right. Well, that was all redundant information.
I don't know if we outright said, maybe we said we were going to talk about the podcast later, but it is good to mention, Jay... wrote
and,
the
and honestly Jay's favorite character in all the land is Cyclops.
Yeah.
So that he got that he is able to basically write the origin an update of an origin story is
pretty
great.
Cool.
Man, I have such strong feelings about the X-Men now that I just did not think I would have six months ago.
Well, the podcast, like you were saying, is sort of infectious and makes me want to revisit some of the older stories. Like, I listened to one about the Brood Saga, and I haven't read the Brood Saga in years.
Maybe. I've got the third hardcover. I've been buying the X-Men Omnibus hardcovers, like Claremont and Byrne did, and maybe I should revisit, and this would make me read that third volume I haven't even taken off the shelf. Hang on. Okay, last but not least, Anna, I know you had just dove into Dispatches from Elsewhere on AMC. Where'd you find this?
So, I don't actually know where you can stream it. A friend of mine, I guess, she bought it on Amazon.
Okay.
But she had to buy it, I guess. I think if you have a cable package, like, you can log into AMC's website.
People have cable?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a weird thing. That's why she bought it. But she then loved it so much she bought a DVD copy of it.
Oh.
And gave it to me and made me watch it.
How old school.
I know. I had to go find a DVD player. So I plugged it in, and I'm so glad that I watched it. It is such a weird, delightful, surreal experience. It is largely a character-driven piece about four people who encounter what is effectively like a life-changing experience through this game.
It's like an alternate reality game, right? With ARG or whatever they call those.
Yeah. Is it augmented reality?
Or something like that,
yeah. Effectively, it's a game that, like, sort of, like, blends a lot of, like, real-world stuff into it. Like, it takes place in real life, and, like, you're receiving phone calls and text messages and, like, encountering things out in the world that are... They all loop into a larger narrative. And the story follows these four characters, one of whom is the most, like, well-written and, like, incredibly relatable trans character I've ever seen on TV.
Okay.
Including but not limited to the fact that, like... That was a weird way of saying that. But she is so realistic in the way she is written that, like, there were things that I was seeing on the screen that I was thinking to myself, like, wow, nobody ever gets that right.
Huh, okay.
She is actually the romantic lead in the movie, which is, like, really cool.
Uh-huh.
Because that never fucking happens.
Yeah, yeah.
And her, like, chief romantic interest is, like, this guy with, like, a tremendous amount of anxiety. And I found him extraordinarily relatable. In fact, every single character in this is extraordinarily relatable, even if you may not relate to them for positive reasons.
Right.
Which I think is actually really important, to see someone, like, struggle with something you're struggling with.
Mm-hmm.
And then to ultimately overcome it is really cool. And that's sort of what the show is about. Like, it's about these people who have, like, problems in their everyday lives, and they're encountering this basically, like, life-changing experience and coming away from it positively.
And the game is something like you get power. Like, what is exactly the deal with it?
So, it is, like, a weird, sprawling conspiracy.
Right there, yeah.
The ultimate, like, conflict is between two groups of people, one the Jejun Institute,
yeah,
and the other being, like, the Elsewhere Society.
Right.
And it's like, really fun to watch it unfold, and it's based on a documentary, and the documentary is based on the fact that this was a real thing that ran in San Francisco from 2008 until 2011.
Yeah.
And I actually watched the documentary last night. And if you do decide to watch the show, I highly recommend you watch the show before you watch the documentary, because it's really neat to see certain, like, scenes in the show that were, like, pivotal experiences for the characters.
Yeah.
Like, see the actual raw footage of people experiencing them in real life at the actual thing. And just, I don't know, it's truly delightful and, like, such a warm, like, wonderful, heartwarming thing.
Yeah.
Like, it was described to me as Fight Club, but for people who like being alive. And I think probably that if you are looking for a warm hug, much like with the show that you recommended, this is probably one to definitely look into.
Okay.
And if you're curious, like me, about what the experiences were like for people who actually encountered this in real life, the documentary is good, but left me with so many more questions. It is just as cryptic as the television show, and if you like a mystery that you can really jump into, I highly recommend it.
So fans of J.J. Abrams' mystery box approach would probably enjoy Dispatches from Elsewhere.
I never saw that, because I don't like J.J. Abrams very much.
Oh, that's his thing. He loves the mystery. Yeah. His whole thing is the mystery box. When he was a kid, this is why he writes his shows the way he does. He had this thing, it was called the mystery box.
Yeah.
And the notion was, like, what was inside it? And the thing is, for him, he's like, it didn't matter what was inside it. It mattered that there was this mystery.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yes, but as a writer, you should know what's inside your mystery box.
Please have something inside the box.
Yeah. But that's his notion of, like, the mystery is its own reward is an interesting philosophy that seems like fits into this a little bit.
Yeah, oh, and it totally does. Like, as you watch the documentary, it's, like, pretty apparent that, like, for the people who created this experience, mm-hmm. it was effectively, like, a living art installment.
Yeah.
Like, the joy of encountering a weird spark in reality was supposed to be what it was. It wasn't necessarily about solving a problem or winning a prize. It was just about being there and living it.
Yeah. Huh.
So, just super, super enjoyable.
All right. That will wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. And until that time,
yo, Battle Joe. On Xena.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.